Our first reading this morning is one for Memorial Day, a reflection by my colleague Victoria Safford. She writes, "I taught once at a farm school in Vermont, where it was the custom on Memorial Day to visit all the little cemeteries in the countryside nearby. There were many of those, some in churchyards or next to open fields where churches used to be, some on windy hillsides, some hidden far back in the woods. The expeditions were led by a teacher who remembered where all the forgotten places were. Children and teachers piled into several cars and went to maybe 6 or 7 graveyards on the day. At the entrance to each one, we would join hands in 2 rows of 10 or 12 and walk slowly across the grounds, looking out for the graves of veterans, many marked by single metal signposts. But some were so old, we had to bend and squint to read the wind-smooth stones. They dated to the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, the Civil War, the 2 World Wars, and the Korean War. There were also a few more recent monuments to men who died in Vietnam. All of these were interspersed at peace again with the town's civilians. It was a very solemn kind of game. On finding the grave of a veteran, someone would call out, 'Here's one.' And we'd clear the leaves and branches off, replaced last year's faded little American flag with a fresh one, and then read aloud the name and dates. Before leaving every cemetery, we'd gather in a circle and some child would play taps on a recorder. And someone would read a verse from Flanders Fields, and then we'd stand in silence till the teacher would say so quietly you could barely hear him, 'Let us not forget.' And we'd move on down the road. The younger children with us on those days were remembering things they had not yet even learned. Names of people dead in wars they've never heard of. Vast sadnesses their minds could not yet imagine. But even they could grasp it. We were honoring those fallen dead so that someday there would be no more. Together, 2 dozen souls of mixed age and experience were remembering the future. It was a prayer, though none was spoken." Our second reading this morning may be a short one, yet I think you will find this excerpt from Paul Reiser's book, Faith Without Certainty, a message that reverberates. Earl?
Liberal theology is not for the faint of heart. It points us in a general direction without telling us the specific destination. It refuses to make our commitments for us, but nonetheless holds us accountable for the commitments we make.
Are we on this one?
Good.
Now, the last time I stood before you, who was here? April 18th, and how long did the service go? A really long time. I'm out to outdo myself today, not in length, but in brevity, and hopefully a bit of conciseness. Last year, this Sunday, we talked about our responsibility to our veterans and to those who had died in our name. And it's true that this year, well, earlier this month, we had a memorial service for a veteran, and I've seen this before and not in this space. A military honor guard came, and there was a lone bugler playing taps. And I don't think there was anyone in the room that didn't feel the chill. That chill is on, this is sort of an impressionist presentation this morning. That chill is on one hand. And this is the closing Sunday in a month where we're focusing on our promises and covenant. And covenant is a word we've been speaking, using a little more often here and in other Unitarian Universalist churches. Who can tell me what a covenant is? We're going to get small church on you now. Raise a hand. Who can tell me what a covenant is? Michael. An agreement. Any kind of agreement? A binding agreement. A contract. Binding agreement, contract. A promise. A sacred promise. What's a sacred promise? How does that differ from the mortgage I'm going to be signing when I close on my house on Thursday? Ooh, did you hear that? It's a sacred promise because it has to do with both of our survivals. And I don't know if you can see it. There's a look of seriousness in those eyes that is real. I am not going to disrespect that message because she's right. Earlier in the month, in a story she told, Jolinda gave what I think, besides what we just heard from Susan, was the best definition of a covenant that I had ever heard. She was talking about the kinds of agreements that we make, and she said a promise is something, if you and I have a promise, and you don't, well, let's say I don't fulfill my end, you can decide to say, I'm not going to play that game either. You can take your marbles and go home. And we'd understand that. A covenant is something, if I don't fulfill my end of the bargain, you keep filling your end of the agreement. Why? Because it's what you need to do, because you know you survive, depend upon it, but also is your sense of yourself, your integrity. Now, the thing is that Unitarian Universalism, and I say this at every new member orientation, I say this more often than I really ever care to. When you ask us in our society about a faith you don't know much about, the first question is, what do you believe? That's not the right question for us. Why? Because we're a non-creedal faith. What does that mean? What does that mean, a non-creedal faith? Wow. Do you want the microphone? I want to see if I've got this back. You do not have to agree to us any set of beliefs to join us, but you do have to what?
Engage in covenant to be part of our beloved community.
And you do have to respect other people's beliefs. That would be part of that covenant. Is that written down anywhere? All right. That's not written down anywhere. So if I were to come up to you, looking startled, and say,
We're part of a covenantal faith. And if you don't know what the covenant is, what are you going to be feeling?
Lost.
Maybe bewildered. Like you've signed on to something you don't know about. Like there's an expectation you don't know how to fulfill, even if you think you might or might not want to. In the first congregation I served, it was very clear that we needed to come together on a direction for the congregation. It had been years since we had done a mission statement, and so I started preaching mission. And everyone's eyes, when I talked about that, glazed over. I'm a slow study. It took me nearly 2 years to realize that the primary reason for that is the congregation was made up by government employees and teachers, also government employees, and mission came from the top down. That's not what I was asking for. I wanted something from the bottom up. I wanted enthusiasm. And I was killing it by how I was talking about it. In the same congregation, when our religious educator put together a beautiful booklet for all the families with children in the Sunday school program, and it talked about rights and responsibilities and what the rules were going to be and the consequences, and when she put the name covenant on top, no one wanted to sign it. No one. There's a smile on the back. Yeah, you know that. And yet we are a covenantal faith. When the folks came over from England wanting to found new religious communities, it was really because they wanted a different way of organizing those congregations. They didn't want, by and large, at least some of them, those who were more congregationally minded, our ancestors here in this congregation, religious or otherwise, they wanted to be able to be accountable to one another and not the hierarchy of a bishop or a king. And we have great records from one church, and this is outlined in a fabulous book published a number of years ago by Alice Blair Wesley called Our Covenant, The Lay and Liberal Doctrine of the Church, the Spirit and Promise of Our Covenant. Folks in Dedham, Massachusetts, villagers, wealthy merchants, farmers struggling to begin to make a living in the new country, got together, and before they talked about God, before they lit one candle, before they made one prayer, before they put one leg of the foundation on their church, they spent a year talking about how they wanted to come together in religious community. They asked each other, what's most important to you? How do you want to move in this new society? We have inherited that religious tradition, but we haven't written down what our covenant is. And what? We do have a covenant of respectful relations. Who can cite chapter and verse of our covenant of respectful relations? You can. Yeah, we know you can. It is on the website. It is on the website. Our saving grace. Alice Blair Wesley has this to say. Oh, and we resist covenant because, this is an important point, if I promise something to you, especially to a stranger, I don't know you terribly well, so I'm looking at you. Nope, I'm not going to jump on you anymore. We feel that some of our liberty might be taken away. That's the fear. And what is this? Are they? And if I say, well, you have a covenant with me, well, I'm asking something of you, right? So we always have an opportunity, should we choose to claim it, to figure out and to do some serious thinking about how we want to be in relationship with one another. Alice Blair Wesley says this: ultimately, the only freedom adequate to human dignity is the freedom to do what love asks of us. And so our question, the question we have always as Unitarian Universalists, or even people who may not want to join the church but are thinking people who care about living as responsibly and respectfully as possible, is to always be asking ourselves what love demands of us. When we think of agreements, when we think of covenants, we might think of marriage vows. After my divorce, I had a little chip on my shoulder. My wife left me a number of years ago. And so what I did was I copied down the vows that I had said to her and she had said to me, and I put them, folded them up in my wallet. And I carried that around like a badge of honor for a year until I finally had the courage to pull it out and realize she hadn't broken any of them. She was following where love took her. And I need to be really clear here. It wasn't about me. My ex-wife, Jennifer, at the age of 30, discovered she was lesbian. She needed to go where love took her, and I needed to let her go. I did that with sadness, but I never thought I wouldn't do it. It was something I needed to do. She needed the freedom. So we ask ourselves what love asks of us. Anyone want to hazard an answer for them in this moment of time? It's a huge question. Oh, you are brave.
To overcome the fear of commitment.
To overcome the fear of commitment. To follow new responsibilities. To follow and uphold your responsibilities. Even when it's hard. Anybody else? I don't have a mic, but I need to come back so I can speak it back. What?
Honesty.
Honesty. Always, always honesty. Another hand? Whoop. I'm going to take one more, and then I'm going to be done with my Phil Donahue impersonation. With apologies to Tina Turner, what does faith have to do with it? All right. So I've done this whole thing to talk a little bit about covenant, to unpack it, but also to put something out to you. This question, what does love call us to do, is going to be the center point of a program I'm bringing to the church starting in September. It's called Wellspring. And I'm going to be working with up to 8 people. If you're interested, talk to me. And we're going to spend a year on spiritual deepening. We'll be working with spiritual mentors and guides. We'll be working some with spiritual practice. We'll be learning a lot more about Unitarian Universalist history and about how we move as people of faith in such a complex, changing world. I'll be writing about more, but I wanted to give it a good plug now because time is short with summer coming. The program will begin in September and run through May, and it's going to be limited to just 8 people. We're going to start small. Hopefully some of those people can work as facilitators so we can expand the program in years to come. What does love call us to do? It's a question I can't answer for any of you. I can barely answer it for myself. But it's what calls us forward as people, forgive me, of faith. Thank you. Thank you.